This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Status update on good jobs. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. And here's what's coming up this hour.
The good news is that there are more decent paying jobs today than in 1991. The bad news is that the number hasn't kept up with the population growth.
Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch is getting the rookie treatment from his colleagues. Hear the thankless task he's responsible for.
American Olympic great Gabby Douglas explains what life hopefully holds for her after gymnastics.
And if you need help deciphering fake news from real news, you might want to consult a librarian.
So basically, this is an education standpoint. Librarians have been tackling fake news since before the internet became popularized. And now they're taking it into schools and have been. You know, now it's combining with curriculum, and they're teaching kids how to figure out if an image is fake.
Reporter Nicole Higgins-Desmet from the Burlington Free Press in Vermont on librarian lessons in fake news. She's here later in the hour. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Well, the number of good jobs for non-college graduates rose from 27 million in 1991 to 30 million in 2015. But the labor market grew too. By 2015, the share of all good jobs that went to non-college graduates fell from 60% to 45% during that 25-year period, leaving 45 million workers in low-paying, sometimes part-time roles that don't offer a path to the middle class. More from Wall Street Journal workplace reporter Lauren Weber. Lauren, what's up here?
Well, there's a common perception, I think, that there are maybe no more jobs or very few jobs left for people who don't have a college degree. And I think in the popular imagination, we're thinking about welders in factories and other kinds of production and manufacturing workers. And this report from Georgetown University, which has a center on education and the workforce, found that there are actually 30 million jobs in the U.S. economy right now that are available, that are being held by people who don't have college degrees. But there's, of course, a but to this. It's kind of a good news, bad news story. One, these jobs haven't totally disappeared, and in fact, there are some that are emerging and, you know, coming out as new kinds of jobs in a more service-oriented economy. The bad news is that there are 75 million workers in the U.S. who don't have a college degree. That means there's only one job for every 2.5 people.
Wow.
Sorry, one good job for every 2.5
right.
people. The rest end up kind of being stuck in either a low-paid job or a part-time job. They don't necessarily have that pathway into the middle class.
Boy, what led to these numbers? Is there a way to pin that down?
Well, the data comes from census surveys. And one thing that the researchers found was that, for one thing, they defined a good job as something that pays $35,000 a year at least. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot. In a lot of places, that's not a good job, but it's basically a living wage. It's about $17 an hour for someone working full-time. However, the median was $55,000, so there are quite a few people earning well over that $35,000 threshold. So it's another piece of good news in this.
Yeah. All right, so I'm looking at this line. High school graduates and dropouts and people with some college are all faring worse now than ever before. Do we know why?
Yeah, well, even though there are these jobs out there available to people who don't have a college degree, more and more of them require some post-secondary education. And in fact, the only group in that bucket of people who don't have college degrees who are doing better are those who have an associate's degree. So if you're a high school dropout, if you're a high school graduate, if you have some college credits, but you didn't finish your degree, those folks are all doing worse. Mm-hmm. And it's because the jobs that are emerging in what the researchers call the skilled services industries, things like financial services, IT, healthcare, jobs like engineering technicians and video producers and psychiatric aides, many of these are jobs that require some kind of certification.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal workplace reporter Lauren Weber. Her piece is called The State of Good Jobs in America. So is it said that teaching is not keeping up or has not kept up with the times?
I think it's not so much the teaching, but you know, community colleges have to be able to move relatively quickly now to see where these jobs are emerging and then start offering programs in them. You know, there's always a certain lag time between what holes companies need to fill and then programs developed to fill them. And I don't know how we're ever going to close that lag time, but it would be nice if we could, you know, make it more quicker that educational institutions can respond to, you know, where the demand is.
Yeah. All right. So where are the most non-college good jobs? Explain the map that's in the story.
Sure. Well, the most jobs are in the most heavily populated states like California and Texas and Florida. However, the highest share, which is a more meaningful way of looking at this, the highest share of jobs that are available to people without a college degree that qualify as good jobs, interestingly, the state that bubbles to the top is Wyoming. Now, the reason for that is because there are very grueling, physically grueling jobs that pay quite well in mining and other extractive industries, you know, natural resource industries. Now, and also Wyoming has a very small population to begin with. But what's interesting is the next states are places like New Jersey and Maryland, states that are much more populous and have more diversity in their economic base. So, you know, those seem like good places for people, relatively speaking, for people who don't manage to get a four-year degree.
Is this at all broken down by gender?
It is. And one thing that's very interesting in the data is that the proportion of good jobs that don't require a bachelor's degree that goes to men and women has remained relatively steady over the 25 or so years that the authors looked at. And it's basically been about 70% men and 30% women, even though there's been this shift to a more service-oriented, you know, non-college labor market. You'd think that, you know, more jobs in service industries like education and healthcare would, you'd see the numbers of women going up because women historically have gone into those kinds of jobs. But that hasn't been the case. It's not totally clear why. But it is one of the reasons why you find that women are going to college at much higher rates than men. It turns out that's sort of their only way up in the labor market.
Thanks, Lauren. Wall Street Journal workplace reporter Lauren Weber. It is 14 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. If car crashes continue to be the leading cause of death for teenagers, is it time to raise the legal driving age? Seems either we're not teaching them safety well enough or they're not capable of learning well enough. Tim Hollister lost his teenage son in a car accident in Connecticut in 2006 and has been an advocate for teen safety ever since. He's with us now to discuss his summer driving campaign. Tim, what's your basic message?
I tell parents to treat driving like flying and to act like an air traffic controller. Every single time your new driver gets behind the wheel, say for the first year or so after they get a license, go through a safety checklist and do a flight plan. What's the destination? What's the route? What's the schedule? Are you going to have passengers? What's the communications plan? Are you rested and alert and ready to undertake this very serious public safety responsibility? So the car doesn't leave the driveway until you, the air traffic controller, gives the thumbs up signal. And then I tell parents that they can monitor compliance with the flight plan by using monitoring technology such as Hum by Verizon.
That and there are other ones, right? I think from insurance companies or even like maybe the Find My Phone just on an iPhone.
Yeah, the general name is telematics.
Okay. And so this obviously is a terrifying time for parents, and tragically, I know you well understand that. What is it about teen development, I guess, or brains where they sometimes just can't piece together the severity or seriousness of all this?
Yeah, well, not sometimes. Recently, science has shown us that the human brain is not fully developed until we reach about age 22 to 25, not 16, not 17. And the last part of the brain that develops is the part that allows us to perceive risk and avoid danger. So this is a biological fact that parents can do nothing about. There's no amount of driver training that can overcome this. So parents need to understand that they need to factor this into their daily supervision of new drivers, and they need to understand that becoming a safe driver takes years, not weeks, not months.
So based on those numbers, I mean, do you get the sense that we allow people to drive too soon in life?
I think most of the traffic safety experts would say exactly that. Do I think we're going to eliminate teen driving in my lifetime? No, I don't think so. So we just have to deal with it and make it as safe as possible.
I mean, what other stat do you need to hear, right, other than it's the number one cause of death among teenagers and those under the age of 20?
Well, certainly, and you know, we pile distracting electronics on top of that. There's certainly it's a huge challenge for parents and for traffic safety advocates. But you know, we are introducing technology like the monitoring technology, like HUM, that it makes it safer. And if we can get parents to understand the dangers of teen driving and do go through this active daily supervision, there is plenty of evidence around the country that we've been able to bring down crash and fatality rates very significantly.
We're speaking with Tim Hollister, parent and also a teen safety advocate, and we're talking about this summer driving safety campaign for teenagers. Tim lost his son to a single car accident about 10 and a half years ago. You say in the notes here that driver's ed does not produce safe drivers. Explain that.
Parents need to understand the limits of driver education. Driver ed is essential because teens need to know how to operate a vehicle and they need to know the rules of the road. But driver education can't possibly introduce teens, much less make them, you know, experienced drivers in the very many myriad situations that they're going to encounter. I always say we train our teens in driver's ed in familiar streets and compact cars, and then they drive an SUV or a high-performance vehicle on a crowded interstate at rush hour. You can't train that through driver's ed. So parents need to understand that a graduate of driver education is a beginner at a dangerous activity, not a safe driver.
Mm. The Reed Samuel Hollister Memorial Fund, how long ago did you start that, by the way, after you lost Reed?
About 6 months after Reed's crash. It's part of the endowment of my church. All of my book proceeds, and if there's honoraria for speaking, all of it goes in there. The fund itself helps infant and toddler education in the city of Hartford, Connecticut.
Boy, was it therapeutic to do that? I can't imagine what you went through.
Well, you know, everything is therapeutic. You know, I always say the three F's, faith, family, and friends, is how you get through a tragedy like this. But the public service angle of the book has been very rewarding.
Teen safety advocate Tim Hollister, author of two books also, by the way. One is called Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. The other one is called His Father Still, a Parenting Memoir. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Tradition dictates that each newcomer to the Supreme Court must serve on the committee that oversees the court's cafeteria, a 185-seat facility open to the public on the building's ground floor. So, for rookie Justice Neil Gorsuch, as the court's most junior member, he is the Chief Justice of the Grill. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
To the newbie goes the unwanted job. Believe it or not, Justice Neil Gorsuch, the newest member of the Supreme Court, is in charge of the court's cafeteria. Jess Braven of the Wall Street Journal has written a story called Supreme Court's Junior Justice Has to Run the Cafeteria. Don't Eat There, and joins us now. Jess, what exactly are Gorsuch's duties?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is a surprisingly intimate institution. There are only about 400 people who work in that building. And the building has in it a cafeteria on the ground floor. And in fact, the cafeteria was required in the original design plan of the 1930s by Chief Justice William Howard Taft, a man known for his great appetite for justice and other things. And since then, it has been a fixture of the building. In the 1970s, management of it was transferred to a committee, and after Justice O'Connor became first woman on the court in 1981, Chief Justice Warren Burger, adding to the food pun supply, appointed her to be on the cafeteria committee that oversees that facility. And ever since then, the junior member of the court has had to be on this committee, and along with rank-and-file employees like, you know, library aides or secretaries or police officers, who keep the court running. And so it's an unusual tribunal within the tribunal there that has a justice along with ordinary employees.
So did it start out as a sexist thing, or is this more of a joke?
Well, Chief Justice Burger's papers are held at the College of William and Mary, and they are sealed until 2026. So we won't know until then what he was thinking, if he indeed wrote it down. We don't know if it was sexist or not. We do know that the cafeteria is a functioning entity that needs to be managed, and having a justice have a role in running it does provide some level of accountability, particularly for other justices. For example, when they want something done, as we reported in today's story, one justice complained about too much salt in the oatmeal, and you know that was revised. Another wanted more mayonnaise in the turkey wraps, and of course, the cafeteria was able to accommodate that request.
Jess, your story also mentions that the food in general is pretty awful there. Why is it so much worse than some other cafeterias in Washington?
I can't say that it is, you know, terrible. And of course, you know, you're referring in particular to the reviews the Washington Post did a few years back of government cafeterias, where, you know, they graded them against each other, and the House of Representatives got an A, and the Pentagon got a C, and the Supreme Court got an F. And why is the food there so bad? There are some theories. Maybe it doesn't get enough foot traffic. Maybe the kitchen is too small. I personally like the soups. I think they're quite good, and you know they're clearly made from, you know, the previous day's leftovers. But I think they're creative and well done.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Jess Braven. 30 minutes now after the hour.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Olympic gold medalist and gymnast Gabby Douglas knows a thing or two about achieving goals you set out for yourself. After conquering London in 2012, she did it again last year in Rio, becoming the only all-around Olympic gold medal gymnast in U.S. history to return to a second Olympics. Now she's helping students make their goals stick as they head back to school. She's endorsing the Post-it brand. What's next for her, though, after gymnastics? Gabby, how'd you ever wind up in gymnastics?
How did I ever wind up in gymnastics? Well, I would have to give credit to my older sister, and she got me started, and I got introduced to the Olympics when I was about age 9. So that's how I got started.
Impressive. And then what was it like when you first learned, what was it, I don't know, maybe 2011 or so, when they announced you were going to the Olympics and had qualified?
It was amazing. I found out literally at Olympic trials that I was going to the Olympics, because they like to keep it super secretive and act like no one, they don't know who's going on the Olympic team, but I found out at trials.
And when the London Games were done, had you immediately set your sights on Brazil, or were you not sure like whether or not the body was going to be able to handle that?
Well, I always knew I didn't want to retire. I wanted to do 2 Olympics. And for me, it's just all about setting goals for me. I knew I was so young and so fresh that I always wanted to do 2 Olympics.
Yeah, that's crazy, though. Nobody else has done that, right?
A few.
Well, not win gold,
but
though.
But yeah, right. And not a reigning Olympic all-around champion.
Yeah, that's insane. That's just insane. So what do you do today to stay in shape? What's a typical workout for you?
Staying in shape. I run. I do a lot of hiking and just a lot of cardio work.
Like what? Running? Your treadmill? Outdoors? Bike?
Both. I don't bike.
Okay. But it's a lot of cardio. Are you lifting weights?
No.
No weights.
I don't lift weights. No.
Front flip still. Back tucks.
Yeah, I mean.
if not gymnastics, what else would you be doing? Or what would you have done, say, as a kid?
I honestly have no idea. I say I would be a track and field athlete, but then again, I hate running. So I don't know how that would work.
Boy, yeah, that's a bit tricky. Coach wouldn't appreciate that, I don't think. We're speaking with gold medal gymnast Gabby Douglas. She's hawking Post-it super sticky notes.
Yeah.
Speaking of endorsements, as I was saying before we started here, I love that athletes, celebrities strike while the iron's hot, like you are here, grabbing endorsements and stuff. What happens next? Because you got to know that this stuff might eventually run out.
What do you mean happens next? I just take one day at a time. I'm telling you, it's all about setting goals. I set my goals on my goal board. I still have my goal board. And even though I'm currently not training at the moment, I'm spending a lot of time with family and friends. But I just take it day by day, and I set up my weekly goals and monthly and yearly.
She wants to do acting in the future. How about that? Gabby Douglas, Olympic gold medal gymnast. 22 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Get away and save up to 30% at participating Lexington and Red Lion Hotels when you book by September 4th. Book your hotel stay and save today. It's the little things that inflict big headaches when you're driving during the summer, right? Like poor road conditions, cellular dead spots, and pretty much anything to do with bathrooms. Here are ideas on how to manage those nuisances from travel expert and consumer advocate Chris Elliott. Chris, set this up.
Well, you're driving along the road and you see a road sign that says clean bathrooms. You know you're in trouble because that implies that all of the other bathrooms that you encounter along the way are not going to be clean. And that, unfortunately, is the case on a lot of these longer road trips that you take through what we like to call flyover country, which, of course, is not really flyover country. People live there. But these standards are not always going to be the same. So there are some places where you can find clean restrooms. I mentioned in the story with a lot of the chain gas stations have standards that are above what maybe you would find there locally. And so you can find, I actually list the gas stations and the stores that have the cleanest bathrooms. And then of course, road conditions too. You know, I mentioned that there are so many roads that have potholes in them. And I talk to people who are extremely annoyed by that. All the more reason to have make sure you're driving a nice four-wheel drive with good shocks this summer.
Yeah. I know you pointed out, I think it's Interstate 81, like somewhere in the neighborhood of Syracuse, where people are saying it's just dreadful. But as you point out, like technology these days can help you. You got folks like, the Waze users who are always pumping that information into that app.
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, if you use an Android phone and you have Google Maps, that actually will give you a workaround if you know that the highway has lots of problems. Other users will too. You mentioned Waze. That's absolutely a great way of finding out if it's a good road or not. And then there are workarounds. I mentioned a couple of workarounds for 81. There are some access roads or service roads that you can use if you're having issues with the potholes. And that's even if potholes are not one of your annoyances, you should still be using something like Waze, which can tell you if there are slowdowns or traffic issues coming up, and then it can actually give you a nice workaround for that.
How about these dead zones for our cell phones?
Yeah, I mentioned this in the story. There are a couple of sites that can help you find out where your dead zones are. A lot of cellular carriers will even give you a map of where the dead zones are. And this is especially true if you're driving somewhere like through the desert and anywhere in the western United States where maybe you don't have complete cell phone coverage. You want to make sure that you're covered, and if you're not, then you can maybe stop by one of these service stations that I mentioned in my USA Today story, and you can check your email there, use their Wi-Fi. But that is unfortunately a really common thing. I've spent a lot of time on I-10 summer, and there areas there where you're just off and you've got nothing. So really important to remember that if you're living in a big city, that cellular service that you enjoy, you might not have that when you're driving through some of the less populated areas.
We're speaking with consumer advocate and travel expert Chris Elliott. He's written a piece entitled "The Worst Road Trip Annoyances and What to Do About Them." I had no idea, by the way, that Nebraska has the least pothole-littered roads. What is it that they do in the Cornhusker State different from other states?
Now I just have to make an educated guess. I think that they have, obviously they're funding their roads, which is, not every state does that. Some of them just rely on federal money, and then they throw in a little bit of their own. But Nebraska also just has fewer roads, probably, and that's not an insult to the good people of Nebraska, but if you're dealing with a large state like California or New York or Florida, you have lots and lots of roads, and so more to maintain. That's probably why, but I would love to drive through Nebraska. It's a beautiful state, a lot of really nice things to see along the way, and good food, too.
Thanks, Chris. That's Chris Elliott, consumer advocate and travel expert. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Read any fake news lately? School librarians have, and now they're teaching students to evaluate and verify news content to ferret out the false from the real. It's a program, strangely enough, called CRAP, an acronym for Currency, Relevance, Authority, Accuracy, and Purpose. More from education reporter Nicole Higgins-Dismet at the Burlington Free Press in Vermont. Nicole, what have you found?
So basically, this is an education standpoint. Librarians have been tackling fake news since before the internet became popularized. And now they're taking it into schools and have been, now it's combining with curriculum, and they're teaching kids how to figure out if an image is fake and look at information that's coming in, looking at the source of it, and, to verify it, who wrote it, what kind of organization is it. So they're, things that, deep skills are getting taught pretty young.
That's interesting.
Basically.
How is it that they basically teach how to critically evaluate a website, for example?
Well, there's a couple of things that a person can do, like a student or anyone else. There's a website called Who Is, and if you put in the URL, it'll tell you, if the organization hasn't scrubbed it, it'll tell you who built that website, who built it, but who owns it.
Okay. Yeah.
So you've got that, and then you can, how to look around a site and find out, who A built it and who is in charge of it, what sites to go to from there to find out who those people are, so where the information is coming from. So it does take some steps and it does take some time.
Yeah.
But, the librarian I spoke to, Shannon Walter, said that she tries to get students, before they click on anything, just to even think, why am I clicking on this? Is it because it's fun and crazy, like that shark picture that went around the internet, the shark and the helicopter? Why are you clicking on it? What do they want from me? So those kinds of questions.
How about some of the other tools, I guess, we might be able to use to figure out if something's legit or not?
Well, in terms of tools, it's old visual techniques that photographers used that they're introducing to students. Look at the shadows. Look at all of the elements of a photo. If something is really, too good to be true, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. What do you know about the person who sent it to you, or the person who posted it, or the organization who posted it? How reputable are they? But, sometimes you can't even go on that, so you have to do your own, no visual techniques, like look at the shadows, look at the background, look at, you know, the different elements, do they gel together? So a photographer was telling me that these are, you know, these are visual techniques that, you know, have been around for, you know, since photography started. So.
Thanks, Nicole. Nicole Higgins-Desmet from the Burlington Free Press in Vermont. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour. You could say that Ray and Wilma Yoder love Cracker Barrel old country stores. USA Today has a story of this couple from Goshen, Indiana. They have visited, you ready? 644 out of the 645 Cracker Barrel stores across America. They crossed their second-to-last location off their list when they attended the opening of the store in Livonia, Georgia, earlier this month. The idea to visit all of the restaurants began 40 years ago when Ray Yoder, who's now 80, was working for Coachman RV. As he delivered recreational vehicles across the country, he would stop at Cracker Barrels for meals. The Yoders, who have been married 60 years, say they always follow two rules when visiting a Cracker Barrel. Tip and buy an item. Janella Escobar, the chain's director of corporate communications, told ABC News, "We think of Cracker Barrel as a home away from home for our guests, and the Yoders are certainly a part of our family." As for their final Cracker Barrel destination, the Yoders plan on crossing the final one off their list later this year. It is in Tualatin, Oregon, just south of Portland. Again, 644 out of the 645 Cracker Barrels this couple has been to. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.